Good Monday morning. Hope your day is off to a pretty good start so far. It's coming up to 10:06. Hi and welcome to the second hour of our show. I'm Rick Howe with you until 12:30 this afternoon, and here's what's ahead on the show for you today. Well, it's time this hour for Science Files, and St. Mary's astrophysicist Rob Thacker is my guest this morning, and I'll make the introduction in just a moment. Then at 11, it's your turn. We're going to the phones next hour for our first open hour of the week. Manic Mondays ahead, and as always, anything goes in our open hours. After the news at noon, Ben Buchwald with Bicycle Nova Scotia is taking issue with critics of HRM's push for more bike lanes. He'll join me this afternoon, and so will historian Leo J. DeVoe. Leo's here this afternoon with a Halifax History Moment for us. But right now, it is time for Science Files, our weekly look at news on the world of science. And back with me in the studio this morning is St. Mary's University astrophysicist Dr. Rob Thacker. Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
Beautiful looking day out there.
It was, and what an amazing weekend of sport it was.
Now, do you watch any of that tennis?
I was actually watching the cricket.
Oh, the cricket?
Yes, the cricket World Cup final.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, yeah. It went. It was.
Let me guess. England versus Pakistan.
England versus New Zealand.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Okay. So after 50 overs, it was tied.
Yeah.
So they had the equivalent of like sudden death, which is another over, and then it was tied after that, and England won on a count back of the number of boundaries scored, and it's like. No one could have possibly predicted
that.
It's going down as the greatest one-day game of cricket ever played.
Well, and some are suggesting the greatest game of tennis ever played took place yesterday at Wimbledon with Federer against Djokovic. And that went into a marathon session as well.
I know. And so it was the 12-12 tiebreak. So you've got to wonder, could it have been like the 2008 final, Federer and Nadal, which just kept going and going and going as well?
Yeah, there was one game that this didn't set a record. The record for most... The longest game that lasted over 3 days.
Yeah, it's the Eisner-someone game.
Yeah. Yep. And then on the Saturday morning, Serena and Halep had a very great tennis match
yes.
as well.
Didn't she play well?
Halep played, beat her. Yeah. And again, a couple of great weekends, a great weekend of sports, I guess, all around.
Absolutely.
Unless you're a Blue Jays fan, of course. The Jays lost 2-3 to the New York Yankees.
Okay.
Indeed.
But someone has to lose something.
Yeah, indeed. Dr. Rob is here to, talk about science. And in particular, we're going to focus a bit this hour on what's taking place on Saturday coming up, the 50th anniversary of the moon landing, July 20th, 1969. And Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin, the first two men on the moon, one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind, said Neil Armstrong as he stepped from the lander onto the moon's surface.
Yep.
What do you remember about that day?
I don't remember anything because I wasn't born.
You were? Oh, my. Am I that old? Or
yes,
are you that
you
young?
Well, I was born in 70, so I missed it by a few months.
Yeah.
So
I recall walking along. I was living in Montreal at the time, and it was evening. And I'm not sure where I was coming from, but I was walking back home, and I just remember looking up at the full moon that night and thinking, wow, there's a couple of men walking on that moon right now.
So the thing that I do remember is being very, very young, and there was the footage where they come down and the eagle has landed and you see all the blast come up. And that footage was played so many times on TV after the event. And I just remember being a kid and seeing that and remembering that and having that like etched in my brain because it was being played so much. And then by the time I could start to read, my dad was reading me stories about what the astronauts went through and so on. That was one of the first things I remember my dad reading to me, actually.
I'm looking at some pretty amazing kind of things you never knew about NASA's landmark moon mission.
Yep.
For example, the lunar spacesuits were created by a lingerie company. Playtex, a company better known for inventing the Cross Your Heart bra, was hired to create the suits that would protect the astronauts from the moon's airless environment. Interesting.
Well, I mean, they have the knowledge of building support systems and so on. And I mean, that's really important. I mean, they're obviously good at what they do. So it's not surprising that they were asked to do this.
The crew had to hawk their autographs for life insurance.
Yeah, that one's kind of incredible. So those were the Apollo 11 envelopes, right? And so some of them have sold for a fair amount of money, I think. And so, yeah, they literally signed a whole bunch of envelopes and had them postmarked and whatever. And so that was the sort of way they would have some kind of insurance if something went wrong. I mean, it feels kind of macabre, really, doesn't it?
It really does.
Yeah.
Aldrin and Armstrong left their, I'm reading here exactly now, left their poop and their pee behind.
Yeah. In fact, there's a fair amount of poop and pee over the moon at the various landing sites. Not sort of like open. I believe it's all packaged. But anyways.
NASA says the six Apollo missions that put men on the moon left behind 96 bags of human waste.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. I mean,
that's
triggered the thought about Everest and how Everest, there's all of this waste there as well that has to be cleaned up. And so.
Yeah, NASA quarantined the astronauts upon their return for fear of moon plague.
Just wanted to be careful. Still, we aren't fully 100% sure how the body's immune system reacts to low gravity environments. And so they just wanted to be careful, and there was no ill effects at the end of the day, so they were fine. But it's a sensible precaution.
Yeah. Did you know that Sudbury stood in for the moon during the training mission?
I did. Yes, yeah. I did.
Have you been to Sudbury at all?
I have been to Sudbury.
Yeah, so you know it is a bleak landscape.
I've been to Sudbury. Well, it's not as bleak as it used to be because they've done a big replanting scheme up there.
I've been a while since I've been there.
Yeah, so. So it's actually, there's a fair amount of new young trees up there now, and it's really quite pretty now, I would say.
Yeah, but back in training for the mission, they would, again, walk over the rocks and just pretend they were on the moon. And very interesting. And a Canadian was also responsible.
So now, which island is it? So you were talking about places in Canada that stand in for otherworldly bodies. So it's either Baffin Island or Devon Island that's being used to stand in for Mars.
For Mars. Yeah, I think it's Baffin, but I'm not 100% sure of that. A Canadian, by the way, his name is James Chamberlain. He's a former top Avro engineer whose suggestion became an integral part of the moon landing. He suggested a command module and a lander attached so that the command module, after the lunar lander detached from it, the module would continue to orbit around the moon, the lander would land, because initially they were looking at a one-unit kind
of.
Anyway, thanks to Canada and... Canadians, of course, continue to play a bit of a role in the space program.
It increases your docking, but in terms of like having various scenarios for getting back and so on, it's better from that. And it changes the fuel load, as I remember as well. So this is a sensible and clever idea. So I do want to say, seeing as we got calls from Ken Pinto, I believe, about what we were doing for the Apollo
50. Oh, yeah, yes. What have you got
so
planned?
So we have negotiated with Criterion Pictures to show Apollo 11.
Ooh.
So we'll be showing Apollo 11, probably doors open at 7:30, 7:45 on Saturday night in the Scotiabank Theatre at St. Mary's.
Excellent.
Yeah. It'll be free. One of the conditions we had for getting the license was that it would be free. And so we're still paying a little bit of money to do it, but nonetheless, it'll be free for the public. And so we've got about 168 seats.
Now, tell me about Apollo 11. This is a documentary.
So this is a documentary that was made primarily from all of the really large format film that they used and got stored away and so on. And then it was recovered and digitized and so on. And now they've actually made this documentary. And so it's won a whole bunch of awards. It was a Sundance special selection and so on. And it's a really good movie. The one thing I will say, it's what's called cinema verite. So there's no voiceover. It's literally using all of the footage of the time. There's a bit of Walter Cronkite in there, apparently. So it probably isn't too good for the kids.
Yeah.
The kids might get a bit bored by it, just so everyone knows.
Okay. Let's go to the phones. And Brian's giving us a call this morning. Hi, Brian.
Good morning. I got a question for Dr. Rob about the moon and tides. It's probably a silly question, but just thinking about it, I'm kind of curious. So when the moon travels around the Earth, its gravity pulls on the water and creates like a bump on the Earth, and we travel through it, and that causes tides, right?
Say that again. I didn't hear.
Yeah.
Okay. So as the moon goes around the Earth, its gravity pulls on the water, the ocean water, causing it to rise towards the moon, and that it's really us spinning, right?
It's not so much the moon goes around the Earth once a month, okay? Whereas we feel tides on a daily basis, and that's about the Earth spinning.
Okay, so it's us. Well, my question is, at high tide, because of the moon's gravity is pulling at most at that point, would we be lighter than at low tide?
So,
give him some pause for thought here, Brian.
I suppose in a tiny amount, yes, you are. But it's not like you're going to be floating away from the surface of the Earth. And so the overall acceleration relative to the Earth, that's hardly going to change at all, because that you've just got a secondary gravitational force that's creating a small push. It will be a tiny, tiny, tiny change.
Yeah. That's what I thought.
Okay.
But I wasn't sure.
Yeah.
Appreciate the call.
All right, thank you.
All right, appreciate it. Thanks. 10:15 is our time. 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. Mike, stay there. You're coming up next. But first, we have to take a quick break. Then back to hear more from Dr. Rob Thacker on Science Files. We're back right after this. 10:18 on a Monday morning. It's Science Files this hour, and Dr. Rob Thacker from St. Mary's University is my guest here. And if you've got a question for us, 902-405-6000. Or 1-877-801-8255. Mark emails a question. He says, prior to the lunar landing, how did NASA determine where they would land, and how did they know that the lander wouldn't plunge deep into the moon dust and potentially get stuck, Dr. Brown?
Well, they didn't. I mean, that's a perfectly good question.
Oh, really?
I mean, so what they did have, though, was sort of knowledge of what had happened with various rovers that had been sent to the moon and so on. So that knowledge was there. But no, I mean, they were seriously concerned about what would happen when there was a landing, and the hope was it wouldn't go down, because at the end of the day, if you're landing on a surface, you may know what happened in other places, but where you choose to land could be different, right? So there was always a little bit of risk involved there. But as we all know, the lander was fine, although the landing itself was pretty hair-raising. So nonetheless, having to go over the crater and boulders and everything. But in the end, it all worked out. So they did a lot of reconnaissance of where they wanted to actually land.
Didn't they land in the Sea of Tranquility?
Yep. So they did a lot of surveillance and reconnaissance ahead of time. So they had basically scoped out a bunch of different possible landing sites. I can't remember precisely why they picked that one. Not off the top of my head. I'd have to do some research on that. But nonetheless, it was easier for radio transmissions as well. So it makes sense.
Why do they call it the Sea of Tranquility, by the way? I mean, I know it's a crater-like kind of appearance here, but...
Well, the seas have always been called, I mean, that goes back a long time. Okay. They were called seas before we knew what the moon really was, to be honest. And so why it's called Sea of Tranquility, I don't know. I would have to look that up.
Okay. And this is from a caller wondering, India, he writes, just canceled a launch to the moon. Do you know why?
So that's a good question. And there's technical snag is being quoted in the press. My guess is they found something going on during the fuel loading or something like that. I don't honestly know, and I haven't seen a report that says precisely what it is, although who knows, there may be something on social media somewhere.
All right. Rob emails us to say that he lived near Sudbury at the time NASA was using that terrain. He says, I remember tape that said, do not trespass NASA test site. And he says, plus the reason it was so bleak was because the nickel mine smokestacks were short back then. They built what was called the super smokestack later. Most of the smoke then drifted elsewhere. But again, Sudbury used as the training ground for that.
So Edward Butinsky took some quite famous pictures up there as well, and sort of like made Sudbury really look like a moonscape.
It was bleak looking. I mean, it really was. David's given us a call this morning. Hi, David.
Hi. I have a question about the ultimate selfie.
All right.
Like, the
I'm
ultimate
not a conspiracy
selfie, okay.
theorist and this and that, but how did they manage to take a picture of themselves when they landed on the moon or walked on the moon? Do you know what I mean? Like
as Armstrong stepping from the lander onto the moon's surface, we saw that photo, that film of him stepping down. How did they do that?
So that's known. Okay, so what happened there was they actually had a TV camera that came down off the side of the lander. Right. So that's how that was all done. Yeah.
Oh, cool. Excellent. Thank you for clearing that up.
Yeah, no,
end of another conspiracy theory, right?
Yeah.
No. I mean, it had to be done somehow, but I just didn't know how.
Yeah.
Okay, excellent. Thank you very kindly.
Appreciate it, David. I also heard people ask me questions, why is the American flag blowing in the wind if there's no wind on the moon?
Because the only time it blows in the wind is when you actually have the launch.
But it also was hooked up with wires to make it look like it was floating or fluttering in the wind.
Okay.
So if you look at a picture...
I know it was held up with a piece to hold it up.
But if you look at the flag, it's kind of like... It's kind of looks like it's blowing in the wind because they purposely made it look like that.
Okay.
just That's my impression, okay. Anyway.
Okay.
We'll have to look this up.
I have to confess, I do not spend a lot of time reading about this kind of things.
Here's another little unknown fact about the moon. Remember John F. Kennedy? It was his speech that kind of prompted NASA to get that whole moon thing going.
Yeah, no, I know what you're going to say.
Yeah, apparently, the president really didn't care about the moon. No. Says here in private, he was a pragmatic politician, focused on earthly concerns. Everything we do ought to be tied into getting to the moon ahead of the Russians, he said, but I'm not that interested in space.
This comes back to the whole reason why they did that. It was a national pride in the middle of the Cold War.
Because the Russians had put up Sputnik.
The Russians, so they were ahead, right? And the Americans had no choice but as a matter of national pride to catch up. And so they went full on. 400,000 people employed at peak NASA.
Yeah.
Right? That is a heck of a lot of people. 4% of their tax base was going towards this, right? That's a phenomenal amount. Now it's like less than one-tenth that, right? So, yeah, serious piece of political maneuvering, for want of a better term. But you do have to say that Kennedy was a phenomenal orator,
yep.
Right? And so when he stood up and said this,
yep.
He literally swept the rest of the nation up with him. Although, there were people who objected during the whole Apollo mission time. I mean, it's known that there were a number of opinion polls conducted. And, you know, it was only like 60% in favor at the time. There were quite a number of people vocal against it.
Minutes after the lunar module touched down in the Sea of Tranquility, Buzz Aldrin radioed back to Earth to say, quote, I'd like to take this opportunity to ask every person listening in, whoever and wherever they may be, to pause for a moment and contemplate the events of the past few hours and to give thanks in his or own her way. He then switched off the radio, opened a small plastic container of bread and wine, and read privately from the Gospel of John. He took communion on the moon.
Yep.
Fascinating.
Yep. First ever liquid poured on the moon was for communion.
Indeed. Yep. 1024, again, here we are 50 years after that moon landing, almost 50 years, 50 years this Saturday. What's the significance of this, Ra?
I mean, this is a foundational event, I think, for most of the last few decades. I mean, if you go back to the 70s, it really did describe the 70s. The zeitgeist of everything, you just look at David Bowie and so on, it just permeated culture.
Yep.
It's a little bit difficult to sort of draw a straight line from that to what we have now, because I think to a certain extent, things have really changed and society is really changing in a number of positive ways, although there are a number of issues that we still have to deal with. And so now I'm not so sure that it has the same kind of meaning to people. And this generation is looking for its own achievements as well. And in different ways as well. I mean, I'm going to just throw it out there. When I look back and see all the footage from the moon, and now it feels a little bit anachronistic because there's all these guys there and where are the women? Right.
Well, but the next mission, they are saying, will be a man and a woman who will be.
Yeah, but I'm saying that's how things have changed. And that's why things are changing for the better. And it's going to be really important to get equality in terms of these developments in technologies and space. There's no reason why a woman can't be just as good as a guy in a spacesuit. And there are all of these issues that we learned about female physiology through studying them in space as well, and that we can use in these missions. Right. So there's a lot of new and I think fantastic developments in terms of bringing quality towards this kind of exploration and space travel.
Yeah, we've seen a lot of study about the impact on the male body. Have we seen...
There's been a heck of a lot of research done on the female body, particularly with long term. There's a lot more going on in a female body in terms of like overall hormone loads from month to month as well. So understanding that, there's been a lot of research done on that and a lot of papers written about it too. More to be done, of course, right? And there's more to be done and learned about the immune systems in general, not just male or female systems too.
Before we wrap up for a news update coming up here, there are flags on the moon, or there's one flag left on the moon, the one from Apollo 11. But every Apollo mission that went to the moon had a flag, and I'm reading here, the entire set of Apollo flags was purchased at Sears by a trio of NASA secretaries who were sent out during the lunch hour.
Oh, that's just unbelievable.
Oh, my. Anyway, 50 years this Saturday.
I've got to really question whether that's true or not. I really love to know the deal, because you would think if they actually set these things up with the rod to keep it sort of straight out and everything, they would probably do a little bit more than buying it from Sears.
Maybe so. But it's just one of the folklore that's now associated with that mission to the moon. 50 years ago, this coming Saturday. We'll hear more from Dr. Robin Take your calls as well at 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. But first, we have to take a break for a news update. Then back with more Science Files. We're back after the news, and the news is coming up next. Ah, 50 years ago this Saturday, we put two men on the moon, Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin. July 20th, 1969, part of our focus here this morning on Science Files with Dr. Rob Thacker from St. Mary's University. And if you've got a question for Dr. Rob, let's hear from you at 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. Good morning, B.
Hello.
How are you today?
Fine.
Good.
I just want to put this in historical context. The person who was finally responsible for the Saturn rocket that landed man on the moon was the same one who invented the V-1 and V-2 rockets that created terror over London during the Second World War.
Yeah, Werner von.
I wouldn't call that a crime in a sense, because we were doing the same thing with the Lancaster and B-17 bombers over Germany. But he's in the Dr. War Criminal in the sense that he used slave labor to build his rockets in Germany. And even though he wasn't directly connected with actual supervising them, he knew what was going on, and he let it happen with his influence over him. He could have improved the situation. The average of 30,000 slave laborers died every 3 months in New York City, and he wanted more and more slave laborers.
I appreciate the call. But the Russians and the Americans, the Allied forces, it was a race on to see who could get to the German scientists strides.
The whole war background here is actually the key thing, because what you've got to remember is rockets. I mean, a lot of what was used there was basically developed initially for intercontinental ballistic missiles.
Yep.
Right, so this was very much a wartime thing, and as we were saying, it was the Cold War. So there were war criminals. As just was mentioned, there was war criminals on the Russian side as well. And so, it's a huge irony of humanity that we do these unbelievably incredible things on the backs of trying to kill one another very often as well, like the technology we've developed. And I'm going to do something very unusual. I'm going to point to all of the engineering that was developed to create firearms, right? There's precision engineering that's gone on in those that we have actually spun off into other things that we get the benefits of. But it was really designed to improve engineering tolerances for creating firearms and things like that in the very sort of like late 1800s and so on. And all of that spins off into other things. It's a sad thing about the nature of humanity in general that we do actually wind up benefiting horrendously from these things that we do to kill one another. It's really sad, but that is unfortunately the way we live it. And I mean, a lot of the things like the atomic weapons. We learned a lot about radiation exposure from dropping the atomic weapons. It's just, what can you say?
I watched a news piece the other day on the race to space as far as the private sector is concerned, with Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos, and Richard Virgin
Galactic,
Basically, it's suggested that Tesla has the advantage right now. He's already refueling and providing supplies to the
International Space Station.
International
right,
Space
yeah.
Station, yeah.
I mean, there's no doubt that from a private space perspective that Musk is really in competition with Boeing. Boeing's been doing this for a very long time.
Yep. Yeah.
So they are the two who are sort of like duking it out. But Blue Origin could come up. They have to develop a new rocket. They have the new Shepard, which is going for suborbital flights, but they have something called the new Glenn that they're developing for orbital flights. They're still a little bit behind, so they've got to catch up. I mean, they did have a really sort of good piece of news coming out because they repeatedly landed the new Shepard, but they've still got a fair ways to go before they're truly competing with Musk. But, you know, who knows? If they actually get all of the development really well done and they have some successful flights, then they could be picking up contracts for flying satellites fairly quickly.
And Richard Branson seems to be more interested in the tourism aspect of this than
anything. They're going for suborbital flights at the moment. They're not really trying to get into the satellite launching market. With Blue Origin, they already have a few contracts for OneWeb, launching all of the communication satellites for another worldwide internet system. But right now, SpaceX kind of is ahead there. And, you know, if SpaceX really does get this BFR rocket built, then the sky's the limit for where they go.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah. Bezos also, Elon Musk, also very interested in colonization.
Yeah, no, that's the whole point of the BFR rocket, because it's big enough, essentially, with the Starship rocket to go to Mars. How realistic is this? Well, Musk always talks a good game.
He does.
I mean, that is what he is known for. Will it turn into reality? That is a good question. I mean, we've talked about this before in terms of the Lunar Gateway proposal to build this sort of like small space station around the moon. Musk's Starship is actually bigger than the entire Lunar Gateway and has more volume, right? So if they are successful in doing this, they could entirely leapfrog what NASA is trying to do. But, you know, it's a big if.
Well, but my concern, though, is I mean, we handing space exploration to the private sector, and knowing the track record of the private sector, is that a wise thing to be doing?
Well, this is why SpaceX is currently in a little bit of a holding pattern on its human launch capsules, because they're doing the safety test, the whole thing exploded. And so they are in a position where they really, really need to know what's going on before they take things forward.
And I'm thinking about exploitation of the moon, of Mars, and in the name of profit.
I don't particularly see Musk getting ahead on this in terms of like just starting to sell tickets. All of that is going to have to be regulated. I do completely accept that we need to be careful about what we do in terms of exploitation of resources. Yes, absolutely. And that will be on the government to regulate. I mean, one of the things that we have to remember in any kind of capitalistic system is you have to have regulations, because markets fail, and unrestrained markets fail spectacularly very often as well. Yeah. So that will have to be regulated at some level. But nonetheless, I think it's good to see this. I think it's good to see a type of innovation that we haven't really seen before. NASA has tended to go for the really genius engineering solutions. SpaceX tends to go for the good enough solution that's really, really practical, which is, in my opinion, an impressive design route to take. And so far, they're doing a good job of things. No one thought you'd really be able to land these boosters, and they're doing it regularly.
Yeah.
Right?
It's quite impressive, too.
A number of people in the industry were saying, no, they're not going to be able to do it. This is a waste of time, and they have done it. Kudos to them.
Indeed. Let's go back to the phones. Ken's on the line. Morning, Ken.
Hi, guys. This is fantastic what you just said the past few minutes, because what's happened, the biggest news of the past few weeks has been the firing of the head of NASA's manned space flight. And he was, they were delaying the SLS by another year. It was 9 years behind schedule now, and they told Trump it's going to be behind another year. And also the head of NASA, I'm not sure, Rob, I think it's the head of NASA, he's been demoted into a desk job. This is, you know, when the anniversary is this week and everybody's going crazy. And so I think what that means is SpaceX will, because it's been, its track record has been so good, it'll take over. I hope. And that's great news. You can check this out in the website, intotheblack.com.
We'll check it out.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, the other thing here is I think we're in a second golden age. This is the free enterprise golden age, which with SpaceX and with Blue Horizon and with Boeing and Branson. And so realize this is the hottest, coolest time since since the 70s right now. And what Musk has done, again, with the soft landing, it's just people are way more interested in space than they've been for, 30 years.
No question. Appreciate the call, Ken. Thanks,
Ken.
Will the layperson ever be able to afford to go into space, I guess, is the question I'm trying to ask.
I would doubt that that's the case within my own lifetime.
Yeah,
I mean,
really?
I've got probably 30 more years left, and I don't see that happening. When will space travel be something that anyone can afford? I can't put a number on that. I mean, within the next 30 years, probably tickets to Mars, possibly. I mean, I still think that's a really long shot. But, if they get the technology figured out, well, who knows? The bigger thing there will be what happens if things go wrong, because it's one thing to have an airliner crash. It's another thing to have an interplanetary thing go wrong. So yeah, Musk is going to have some real, real regulations to work through on safety. That's absolutely for sure.
They were, I won't say convinced, but they were quite concerned that the Apollo 11 mission might end in disaster. In fact, some of the little-known facts, again, about things you never knew about the moon mission. 2 days before the moon landing, Nixon's speechwriter William Safire penned remarks for the president to deliver in case Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin died.
Yeah, no, I've actually read that speech as well. It's an incredibly beautiful speech, too.
But fortunately...
Yes. Thank heavens they didn't have to use it.
10:43, let's go to Benita next year this morning. Hi, Benita.
Hi. I have a question for Dr. Rob. Good morning to both of
Hi,
you.
Hi, Benita.
My question is, what went bang? Because the Big Bang Theory, right, if you look at it through Newton's thing about movement, right, a thing at rest tends to stay at rest, a thing in motion tends to stay in motion. So something would have had been in motion if you apply that condition, right?
Right. So this is a really tricky question, but I'm going to try and explain it as clear as I can. So the key thing to remember about the Big Bang is, in a way, it's about the creation of space and time. And so all of the things that we talk about with matter, which is what Newton's laws are about, don't really fully apply in the same kind of way to the creation of space and time. That comes down to the realm of what's called quantum physics, which is distinct from what is the classical, beautiful theories of Newton that apply to like how things fall to the Earth, how things go around the moon, and so on. And so the short answer is what went bang? And that's a reasonable question. We don't really know if that is a question with any kind of meaning, because the struggle is, if you're creating space and time, hasn't time always been there? Hasn't it been this thing that's always existed? And so the analogy that you can give to people is, if we talk about going north, if I give you a compass and say, go north, you can go north towards the North Pole, and you keep on going. So you're going north, 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 and then you get to the North Pole and you say, okay, go north. You can't go any further north than the North Pole. So it could be that the big time is the same kind of situation in terms of there being the creation event at the very beginning, and before that doesn't really make any sense.
Mm.
Okay? So it's really tricky, Bonita, and it's not something that lends itself to common sense or analysis by Newton's laws in any way. So it's, I'm sorry I can't give you a really sort of like simple answer. It's just one of those mind-boggling things.
It's one
of those things. Well, I just wondered how... Yeah. Anything went bang if nothing was.
So the honest answer is, so in quantum physics, you can kind of create something from nothing. And there may be something about the universe that means when you add up all of the energy in it, because certain forms of energy in the universe can be considered to be kind of negative, that the overall amount of energy in the whole universe is zero. And if that's the case, then it literally can have been created from nothing.
There you go.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you, Benita.
Thanks.
All righty. Bye-bye.
I know that sounds crazy. It probably sounds like I'm smoking something, but you know, that's where high-energy physics and quantum physics takes you.
But it boils down to it. It's all just theory, right?
It is theory, yeah. But I mean, the quantum theory is very well established by experiment. I mean, quantum theory works. I mean, getting to the quantum theory of the universe, that's the thing where we don't have a proper theory. That could be string theory or membrane theory, any of one of these theories that are very, very, very difficult. But nonetheless, basic quantum theory, yes, we understand that incredibly well, and that works brilliantly. It's one of the best theories we have in physics.
10:46, he is Dr. Rob Thacker. This is Science Files, and we'll be back to hear more from Dr. Rob right after this quick break. Coming up now to 10:49, Dr. Rob Thacker with me here in the studio for Science Files. And Frank with a question here he just sent in via email, and he's wondering, who is Dr. Rob's favorite astronomer in history and why?
Oh, wow. What a question.
Sagan, maybe? Or do we go back to Copernicus?
No. So, who do I think has done really amazing things that were kind of out of their time? The problem is there's so many people to choose from. Like, I mean, like I could pick Jocelyn Bell Burnell for the pulsar discovery. That was amazing. She trolled through literally miles of paper to find that. Not just like a few feet, miles of paper, right? Who else? I mean, you go back to the 1930s and Edwin Hubble discovering the expansion of the universe, but then that is a little bit debated because he had Humason as well, who was helping, and perhaps Humason didn't get all the credit that should have been given there. And then there's Fritz Zwicky, who was this really unusual...
The question was, who is, not who are?
Yeah, no, I know. Who is? I would honestly have to say, given the feat involved in finding it, it's probably Jocelyn Bell Burnell, yeah, to be honest, because that was just an absolutely heroic thing to do.
Sounds right? It.
And I can't think of anyone else who... I mean, yes, there are people who've done amazing things, but I mean, it was just such an amount of effort to find that signal.
Hmm.
So
there you go. 10:50 is the time, and not to connect it to anything we just talked about, but I just taped a show on one of the networks called A Trip to the Moon, 1902. It was made in 1902, A Trip to the Moon. I haven't watched it yet.
French one, was it?
I think it might have been.
Yeah. That's the one where they had the thing go into the moon.
Yeah. Anyway, I'm looking forward to seeing that. I can just imagine.
It's a silent one as well, isn't it? It's 1902.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. Let's go back to the phones, and Bob's on the line. Good morning, Bob.
Morning, guys. How are you?
We're well. How are you doing?
Not too bad, thank you.
You have a question?
Well, Dr. Rob, are you familiar with the discovery of that black hole?
Which one?
Sigma 1, I think they call it. It's a binary system, and theoretically there should be a black hole on the other side of that star, and it's doing a wobble. Isn't that weird? Is 10 million light years far away in cosmic terms?
No, it's actually not very far away in cosmic terms. That's pretty nearby, actually, in cosmic terms. That would be...
maybe it's 100.
3 megaparsecs. That's actually a fairly close galaxy as it goes.
Hmm. No.
Hmm. And what's the
so what's the problem with it is? I mean, it shouldn't be there or something like that?
Yeah, that's correct. Like the behavior of the binary system. You know,
this is an orbitable stability issue, I would guess, then.
Yeah, exactly. I thought it was very interesting, though. Theoretically, it was supposed to be something there, and they're calling it a black hole. Hmm. The first one ever seen, but you can't really see it, of course.
Yeah, no, so this is actually a really interesting area because we're trying to understand how these, what we call supermassive black holes, are involved in the overall evolution of galaxies. And so every time we find a black hole in the middle of a galaxy, that's really useful to us because we try and relate the properties of that giant black hole to the overall properties of the galaxy. And that's essentially the kind of research I do, actually.
All I'm hearing is black hole nearby. Mm. Should I panic?
Oh, come on, no. Three million light years away. You don't have to worry.
Okay,
so it's fine.
Bob, we don't have to worry, Bob.
No, good. Okay, I'll talk to you guys later on.
I appreciate it. Thanks very much. Let's go to Brian next to this morning. Hi, Brian.
Hi.
How are you today?
Very good.
Good. You have a question for Dr. Rob this morning.
Yeah. Immediately after the... Big Bang, I understand that space and time began, and the Big Bang is supposed to have happened 13.8 billion years ago, and it's also my understanding that the universe has been steadily expanding ever since. This is my question. Can you track it back and say that the Big Bang happened, you know, someplace in space?
Okay.
You
know? Yep.
Hmm. Okay.
So that's...
In other words, you'd be able to say it happened here, you know, whatever.
I know exactly what you're saying. This is a very sensible question, and I have a freaky answer.
Uh-oh.
So the fact of the matter...
Time didn't exist again. Okay, go ahead.
Way you have to think about it is that, in fact, the Big Bang happened at every single point of space and time at the same time.
Say that again now?
It happened everywhere.
Okay.
At the same time. Right,
because there's nowhere, and it happened everywhere.
That's the way to think about it. Because suddenly, every single point of space and time is created, so it happens everywhere at one time. Okay.
Okay.
So.
And everyone tends to go, "No, it's going to go back to the same point."
Sitting in the middle of the universe, then.
So you can either say there is no center, or everywhere's the center. It's up to you how you want to say it.
Hmm. Oh, I like being the center.
Yeah.
All right. But wouldn't it be awesome if you could say it's, you know, 3 light years away from Altair or something.
Well, you can hold up a sheet of paper, take a selfie and say the Big Bang happened here, and you're right.
I think I'll pick it out in front of the radio station.
All right. Thank you, Brian.
See you later. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. I'm still having a hard time coming to grips with, again, how did the Big Bang start? What was there to start the Big Bang?
Well, so there are theories where people presume some kind of universe of different dimensions before the Big Bang happened, and that maybe the Big Bang is some kind of result of that pre-universe existence or whatever that is. But I don't really think that helps us in any way, because we've got to find out the physics of what existed before, and we kind of can't do that if we're just stuck in our own universe.
Yeah.
So I tend to be more interested in understanding it from the very, I don't want to say straightforward, because it's not at all straightforward.
Yeah.
It's very complicated. But from things that don't make too many presumptions about things that existed before, and you do that within the realm of quantum physics. But the main thing we have to do is we have to combine Einstein's general theory of gravity, which is this amazing theory, over 100 years old now, with quantum mechanics. And we haven't been able to do that for over 80 years, and we're still struggling with it. Could be string theory, could be other theory. We don't know. Until we have those, it's kind of really difficult to do this properly.
Frank just emailed in regards to the movie Trip to the Moon. He says it's based on Jules Verne's novel or short story From the Earth to the Moon. And he adds, it's funny.
Okay.
Coming up to almost time to say goodbye here, Dr. Rob, but you've got, again, the anniversary is Saturday of the first moon landing, Armstrong and Aldrin. And
doors open 7:30. Yep. We'll start at 7:45. It's about an hour and a half, so it should be finished by 9:15.
Where's it at again?
It's at the Scotiabank Theory, St. Mary's. That's in the Sobey building. And so it will be free. And like I said, probably not a good thing for kids, unfortunately. It's cinema verite, no voiceover. Probably a little bit slow, but absolutely beautiful photography.
Yeah, and this is a compilation of, again, a number of
archives. Yeah, absolutely. It's got some incredible, I've seen these, it's got some incredible images of the huge pad mover that moved the Apollo along,
right.
Huge sort of tractor wheels that it had, caterpillar wheels, and so the caterpillar tracks. And so it looks really incredible.
Any good shots of the astronauts and all close-ups?
There was pictures of them coming on as they were loading up and so on, getting onto Apollo 11 as well. And there's a funny story about a plastic bag, but we won't go into that.
And before we go, I saw afterwards that they were kind of in a almost the thing you see divers go in after a dive here to deal with the
compression belt?
Something like that. They don't do that anymore, do they?
No, you don't. Because, I mean, that I think was largely, they were just being super careful contamination as well.
All right. Anyway, 50 years this Saturday.
Yep.
The first landing
amazing.
On the moon.
Amazing.
It is indeed. Dr. Rob, appreciate, as always, you dropping by here this morning.
Always my pleasure. Thanks, everyone, for the questions as well.
See you next week. Dr. Rob Thacker in Science Files. It is now 2 minutes before 11 o'clock. We're going to break here for a news update coming up at the top of the hour, and then it's your turn. We've got our first open hour of the week coming up next hour. We call it Manic Monday, and our phone lines await your calls at 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. Anything goes next hour. Give us a call. We'll be back with more after the news, and it is coming up next.